Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. I've got to come up with something better. If I'm going to have to say this hundreds of times, we have to think of something better. Please, please help. I might actually make a post. I'm going to make a post. That's what I'm going to do. In the subreddit. Help me come up with a better intro. All right. Today we are discussing Chapter 5 of Stephen Crane's The Open Boat and reading Chapter 6. All right. For Chapter 5, the discussion prompts that I threw out to you guys in the subreddit were as follows. Have you started to get a sense of the backgrounds behind the characters? The reason I ask this question is because, to be quite honest, I kind of haven't. And I don't have a strong sense of the four characters. I don't really have a clear image of their personalities. And I think that's a little bit by design, to some degree. Or maybe it just sort of hasn't sunk in for me, but yeah, I wondered if it was just me or if these four characters are all a little bit vague in their personalities. The second question was, in the previous chapter's discussions, Reddit user Silver Lining commented on the psychological progression of the characters throughout the first four chapters. Chapter 1 was panic, chapter 2 was hope, chapter 3 was denial. Denial was the one where they got all kind of giddy and happy. Chapter 4 was frustration, when the people on the beach wouldn't see them. How would you characterize chapter 5? And lastly, what symbology did you find woven into this chapter? Now, I think either these discussion prompts weren't very good or people just had other things to say, because I had a little flick through the comments before and mostly it was not addressing these questions, which is actually a good thing, because the discussion prompts are sort of there if you can't think of anything else to talk about, and it seemed that wasn't necessary for this chapter, which is cool. La Lone Ranger 94 said, during this chapter, my wilderness first aid certificate kept kicking in during the descriptions about how cold the sailors were, and even the opening line about the foods they were dreaming about. These fellas need to get warmed up, or I fear they might meet their end before getting to land. I loved the description from the correspondent about the babes of the sea. Really loving this prose style. Me too. I am definitely all about this prose style. Stephen Crane definitely had chops. Righty McWriteface said, when the correspondent noticed how the oiler and cook were cuddling together, he referred to them as the babes of the sea, a grotesque rendering of the old Babes in the Wood. Babes in the Wood is a traditional children's tale summed up on Wikipedia as follows. The story tells of two small children left in the care of an uncle and aunt after their parents' death. The uncle gives the children to ruffians to be killed in order... Ruffians to be killed. Ruffians? Is that what that word is? Ruffians? Ruffians? Ruffians?
Ruffian.
Ruffian, a violent person, especially one involved in crime. The uncle gives the children to ruffians to be killed in order to acquire their inheritance, telling his wife they are being sent to London for their upbringing. The murderers fall out and the milder of the two kills the other. He tells the children he will return with provisions, but they do not see him again. The children, wandering alone in the woods, die and are covered by leaves by the birds. Like many morality tales, the story continues with a description of the retribution befalling the uncle. In sanitized versions, the children are bodily taken to heaven. The story ends with a warning to those who have to take care of orphans and others' children not to inflict God's wrath upon themselves. The most famous version of the tale is a ballad by Randolph Caldicote, 1879, and it's available on Project Gutenberg if anyone's interested. Well, there's a cautionary tale if I've ever heard one. If you find yourself adopting orphans, try not to kill them for inheritance money. Techrific said, for some reason I started to wonder about the age of the characters. Did anyone else? I have an inkling that Billy is the youngest, early 20s maybe, followed by the correspondent, then the cook, and finally the captain. I could be completely wrong, but it got me thinking about exactly how old they are. I would love to hear everyone else's take on the age of the characters. Reddit user Long String of Numbers said, I also had a similar thought, although I can't precisely say why I get that feeling. Perhaps something about how Billy is the only one referred to by name, or more likely nickname, shows a kind of casual familiarity between him and the other characters that you wouldn't get in the same way if he was much older or even older than the captain. I mean, if I was in the boat, I would probably address the youngest person much more casually than the others. I also agree that the captain must be the oldest based on how he's described in general and in particular how his tone of voice is described in detail. I can't imagine him as someone who doesn't have years and years of sea experience behind him. I would have guessed the oldest being maybe the cook, and the cook seems to be very experienced, despite his profession not being strictly, crewing a ship. He does seem to know a lot about the waters and the environment that they're in. So I've got this feeling the cook might be the oldest. And the captain even defers to him on a few instances, I think, doesn't he? I think you're probably right about the oiler, Billy, being the youngest, and the correspondent somewhere in between. All speculative, though, and it kind of goes back to my original question of the background behind these characters. It's a bit vague. We don't even really get an idea of what ballpark their age is, right? I can't even say if the captain is in his 20s, 30s, 50s, or 60s. So yeah, it is definitely intentionally vague. Meg Simp said, I've been thinking a lot about the names of all the characters in this story up to this point. Billy, the oiler, is the only one who has been given a proper name. All other characters are simply called by their title, cook, correspondent, captain. The captain is the one who made the reader aware of Billy's name and until recently was the only one to use his name. This also makes me wonder about the relationship between Billy and the captain. Were they friends on the ship? Did they interact more simply because of their positions? Why have they not learned or used each other's names? What does this signify? Any thoughts? My thoughts? I think they know their names. I think they would know each other's names. Maybe it's just, I don't know, you don't use people's names that frequently, do you? Could be just trying to replicate that, but then why do they keep singling out Billy? Maybe because Billy's young. It's all guesses at this point. The Tinosaurus said, did anyone else feel, with this chapter and the appearance of the Thing, that they were suddenly reading a very different sort of story? It might just be because I tend to gravitate towards genre stuff. I love the visual of the correspondent being the only man afloat on all the oceans. La Lone Ranger said, with the appearance of the Thing in the water, it all of a sudden felt like the old man in the sea. I know other people have brought it up, but the parallels between those two stories keep growing. I wonder how long after reading this that Hemingway wrote his short story. We could probably look that up. Let's have a look. The Old Man and the Sea was published... Short novel written by Hemingway in 1951 and published in 1952. All right, so it's a good almost, 55, 60 years? 55 years it is. It's a lot later. Lestealth said, the captain seems to be a grizzled veteran type, given that he's so unfazed by the shark. He seems to be going through the five stages of grief. In the previous chapter, the fools on the beach representing hope, which he was ultimately denied. In this chapter, his apathy towards the shark seems to parallel a denial of their predicament. Techrific said yes, or a resignation, I'm not sure which yet. Is it a bit like, yeah, he's just kind of, he's over it. He's all out of, energy, isn't he, to even respond. So what can he do, but other than just sort of sigh and let it be? Swim said, the mama fishy said, I went back and reread the chapter to see if I could identify any symbology, but I couldn't. I then googled open boat symbology and found all sorts of articles. After reading several of them, I found them very enlightening and will have and it will have enhanced my reading. However, this story is a darn good read, even if I couldn't directly identify the literary symbols, and once again, I wish the internet was available to me when I was in school. I would have slayed those 5-paragraph essays and college papers. Yeah, don't we all wish that we could go back to high school and just be really good at everything? The symbology, yeah, I thought I did spot a bit of symbology at play in this chapter. Namely, there is an interplay between lightness and darkness, light and dark in this chapter. There is a continual mention that it's dark, and there was a continual mention of the lights on the horizon. What was it? It was something about the lights being the only furniture. Is that what it said? It said the word furniture, which I thought was strange, but also quite poetic. Here it is. As darkness settled finally, the shine of the light, lifting from the sea in the south, changed to full gold. On the northern horizon, a new light appeared, a small bluish gleam, on the edge of the waters. These two lights were the furniture of the world. Otherwise, there was nothing but waves. The question is, what does that symbolize? That much I didn't get. I didn't get that far, but I thought it was very deliberate, the mentioning of the darkness and the light. Wasm said, oh, you know what? Actually, just as I was just about to move on, I pictured those two little spots of light in the darkness, and it kind of just clicked just then as I was talking. Maybe those two little dots of light are sort of the remaining hope. Right, everything's gone dark, but there's still that little glimmer of hope, to use the cliche. So they haven't fully extinguished their hope. There's a little bit left. Could be that. Wasm said, if I had to give a feeling to this chapter, with characters drifting off into sleep despite the freezing waters and the lack of any effect the appearance of the shark had on the correspondent, it'd probably be acceptance of the situation, maybe uncaring, reflecting that previous feeling of I survived this far, no way fate will see me dead. I think you're right about it being the correspondent who saw the shark. Someone previously commented about it being the captain, but I think the captain was asleep and it was the correspondent who spotted it. I'm pretty sure that was the case. Now, the feeling of the resignation. It's almost like, I give up. What more can I do? I just want this to be over with. They still haven't, like, completely thrown in the towel. You know, they're not, like, becoming reckless or even, like, suicidal. They're exasperated beyond belief. Wasm continued, while to me at least it seems troubling, if not horrifying, the story of the babes in the woods doesn't end good for the babes, and I'd imagine that a shark is the last thing you want to see when clinging to a tiny boat battered by waves. It'd be like seeing a vulture while out in the desert, nature telling you that it is ready for you to die. Oh, that's grim. Yeah, and also, if you think back to whenever they had to change oarsmen, there was a serious risk of capsizing. So that becomes a lot scarier when there's a shark circling around the boat. And also, with it being scarier, I think the risk of capsizing becomes greater because you become stiff, right? You're going to start overthinking it, and you're probably more inclined to make errors when you're really, really trying hard not to. Silver Lining said, do we know it is a shark visiting the boat? Maybe it's a dolphin or a dwarf minke whale or something. They love circling boats. The correspondent calls it a thing and then it. A very good point. I think in their imaginations it's the worst type of shark for sure, but it could be something quite harmless. This chapter depicts predominantly exhaustion and sleep, so not really much of a chance to explore the psychological progression. However, after the opening sentence, where the oiler and the correspondent were annoyed with the cook, it was good to see respect and kindness between them. I'm sorry. That's all right, old boy. My favourite line, these two lights were the only furniture of the world. I think the cook may have gone for a good old Aussie meat pie and sauce, He was thinking about ham sandwiches, so I reckon he could have smashed one. Yeah, if he's a ham sandwich type of guy, he's probably a meat pie and sauce type of guy. No nonsense grub. All right, that's the discussion for chapter 5. I think we're all pretty keen to read chapter 6, so let's move forward and do just that. This is Stephen Crane's The Open Boat, chapter 6. If I am going to be drowned, if I am going to be drowned, if I am going to be drowned, why, in the name of the seven mad gods who rule the sea, was I allowed to come thus far and contemplate sand and trees? During this dismal night, it may be remarked that a man would conclude that it was really the intention of the seven mad gods to drown him, despite the abominable injustice of it. For it was certainly an abominable injustice to drown a man who had worked so hard, so hard. The man felt it would be a crime most unnatural. Other people had drowned at sea, since galleys swarmed with painted sails, but still. When it occurs to a man that nature does not regard him as important, and that she feels she would not maim the universe by disposing of him, he at first wishes to throw bricks at the temple, and he hates deeply the fact that there are no brick and no temples. Any visible expression of nature would surely be palated with his jeers. Then, if there be no tangible thing to hoot, he feels, perhaps, the desire to confront a personification and indulge in pleas, bowed to one knee, and with hands supplicant, saying, "Yes, but I love myself." A high cold star on a winter's night is the word he feels that she says to him. Thereafter, he knows the pathos of his situation. The men in the dinghy had not discussed these matters, but each had no doubt reflected upon them in silence and according to his mind. There was seldom any expression upon their faces save the general one of complete weariness. Speech was devoted to the business of the boat. To chime the notes of his emotion, a verse mysteriously entered the correspondent's head. He had even forgotten that he had forgotten this verse, but it suddenly was in his mind. A soldier of the Legion lay dying in Algiers. There was a lack of a woman's nursing. There was dearth of women's tears, but a comrade stood beside him, and he took that comrade's hand, and he said, "I shall never see my own, my native land." In his childhood, the correspondent had been made acquainted with the fact that a soldier of the Legion lay dying in Algiers, but he had never regarded the fact as important. Myriads of his schoolfellows had informed him of the soldier's plight, but the dinning had naturally ended by making him perfectly indifferent. He had never considered it his affair that a soldier of the Legion lay dying in Algiers, nor had it appeared to him as a matter for sorrow. It was less to him than the breaking of a pencil's point. Now, however, it quaintly came to him as a human, living thing. It was no longer merely a picture of a few throes in the breast of a poet, meanwhile drinking tea and warming his feet at the grate. It was an actuality, stern, mournful, and fine. The correspondent plainly saw the soldier. He lay on the sand with his feet out straight and still, while his pale left hand was upon his chest in an attempt to thwart the going of his life, the blood came between his fingers. In the far Algerian distance, a city of low square forms was set against a sky that was faint with the last sunset hues. The correspondent, plying the oars and dreaming of the slow and slower movements of the lips of the soldier, was moved by a profound and perfectly impersonal comprehension. He was sorry for the soldier of the Legion who lay dying in Algiers. The thing which had followed the boat and waited had evidently grown bored at the delay. There was no longer to be heard the slash of the cut water, and there was no longer the flame of the long trail. The light in the north still glimmered, but it was apparently no nearer to the boat. Sometimes the boom of the surf rang in the correspondent's ears and he turned the craft seaward, then rowed harder. Southward, someone had evidently built a watchfire on the beach. It was too low and too far to be seen, but it made a shimmering, roseate reflection upon the bluff back of it, and this could be discerned from the boat. The wind came stronger, and sometimes a wave suddenly raged out like a mountain cat, and there was to be seen the sheen and sparkle of a broken crest. The captain in the bow moved on his water jar and sat erect. "Pretty long night," he observed to the correspondent. He looked at the shore. "Those life-saving people take their time. Did you see that shark playing around?" "Yes, I saw him. He was a big fellow, all right." "Wish I had known you were awake." Later the correspondent spoke into the bottom of the boat. "Billy." There was a slow and gradual disentanglement. "Billy, will you spell me?" "Sure," said the oiler. As soon as the correspondent touched the cold, comfortable sea water in the bottom of the boat and had huddled close to the cook's life belt, he was deep in sleep, despite the fact that his teeth played all the popular airs. This sleep was so good to him that it was but a moment before he heard a voice call his name in a tone that demonstrated the last stages of exhaustion. "Will you spell me?" "Sure, Billy." The light in the north had mysteriously vanished, but the correspondent took his course from the wide-awake captain. Later in the night, they took the boat farther out to sea, and the captain directed the cook to take one oar and the stern to keep the boat facing the seas. He was to call out if he should hear the thunder of the surf. This plan enabled the oiler and the correspondent to get respite together. "We'll give those boys a chance to get into shape again," said the captain. They curled down and, after a few preliminary chatterings and trembles, slept once more the dead sleep. Neither knew they had bequeathed to the cook the company of another shark, or perhaps the same shark. As the boat caroused on the waves, spray occasionally bumped over the side and gave them a fresh soaking, but this had no power to break their repose. The ominous slash of the wind and the water affected them as it would have affected mummies. "Boys," said the cook, with the notes of every reluctance in his voice, "she's drifted in pretty close. I guess one of you had better take her out to sea again." The correspondent, aroused, heard the crash of the toppled crests. As he was rowing, the captain gave him some whiskey and water, and this steadied the chills out of him. "If I ever get ashore and anybody shows me even a photograph of an oar..." At last there was a short conversation. "Billy, Billy, will you spell me?" "Sure," said the oiler. All right, there we go. Another chapter down. Wow, how's that use of repetition going there? Really effective in this... That feeling of not getting enough rest before it's your turn to row again. Really, really cool stuff. Alright, go and have your say about this chapter. We're going to be discussing it on the subreddit, reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I thought that was a really good chapter. There were some really nice moments in that chapter. Very cool stuff. Lastly, to support this podcast, if you would be so kind, you can become a Patreon. Donate as little as $1 per month. You'll be getting 30 or 31 or so episodes for a dollar. Pretty good value. Or you can choose whatever value you want to donate per month. Of course, you can continue listening for free as well. We've also got the paperbacks of the Hemingway list. The first two are available, the Stephen Crane book with The Open Boat and The Blue Hotel. And the next book we'll be reading is Dubliners by James Joyce, and that's available too. Go to thehemingwaylist.com and look out for the link that says Our Official Paperbacks, which you may have to scroll to the bottom of the page to find. Now, after we finish this first book, I will be opening up a vote for the fourth book. So the next book is already set. That's The Blue Hotel. Then we'll be reading Dubliners. But the fourth book we read, we haven't decided that yet. And that is only in mid-February that we'll be starting the fourth book, because these first three are all quite short. So it's not that far away. We need to decide what the book is in the next week or so, so that we can publish the official Hemingway list version of it in time to start reading it in mid-Feb. So tomorrow, I think I will open up a vote on what to read next. Now, there's not going to be all of the remaining books from the list on the vote. Some of them there will be removed, but most of them will be on there. I'm vetoing a couple of them because, well, for different reasons, but we'll get around to those ones eventually, but they're not going to be the fourth one we read. Like, for example, War and Peace. We're not going to read that one until last, if we read it at all. Yeah, it's still a bit up in the air. But so, for example, that one won't be in the list for voting for what we read next. All right. Thank you very much for listening today. Looking forward to reading your comments, and I will see you tomorrow.